Welcome to East Meets West, episode 220. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
And
7 more episodes, and we'll be up there with, what is that? Oh, sitcom, 227.
226 would be 7 more episodes. So 8 6. More episodes?
No, 7. No, yeah. 7, right? Because we're at 220.
We're at 220. Sorry, yeah, you're right. I was looking at the number 219 on my screen and adding 7 to that, but that's not right. We're at episode 220. Seems like people were really into the sandwich topic last week. I got a lot of feedback, not only on the blog, but also via Twitter and even a few emails of people saying, if you don't think there's good sandwiches, you got to try their favorite, insert their favorite sandwich shop there.
Yeah, I've come to realize that sandwiches are a very personal thing. It's something that, you know, everyone can have, like, say, a style of shirt, a button-down shirt, long sleeve, but they want a certain cut, they want a certain fit, they want a certain look. And the same thing with sandwiches. You know, yeah, everyone can make a turkey sandwich, everyone can make a ham or roast beef, but you want it done a certain way. You want a certain type of turkey, you want a certain type of tomato, you want a certain type of sandwich bread, a certain type of bread. And, you know, what's delicious to some people might be average to others. And, you know, until you actually go there and eat, it's really hard to judge because is there a baseline standard for sandwiches? I don't think so.
What slide standard?
A baseline standard.
You know, it's funny. I was listening to Anthony Bourdain's latest book, just because Eileen was listening to it on, you know, audiobook in the car. And he was talking about how in his first book, Kitchen Confidential, he had made a big deal about not ordering fish on Monday. And he's taken flack for that ever since from a lot of restaurateurs. And he goes to pretty much a whole chapter. The end of it is, go ahead and order fish on Monday. Our culinary system in the United States has improved to such a length that people actually care now. And so restaurants aren't going to try to feed you the leftover fish on Monday like they might have in the past. And it struck me as an interesting observation. Has the United States improved its taste in food? I mean, and let me give you a little more background from his story. He said when he started cooking in the 70s and 80s, it was all about how fast do you go. It was just, you know, make that steak, cook it up, put it out. There was no muss or fuss. And then sometime in the 80s, his ideas changed and he started to pay attention to, you know, more than just the speed of cooking and the craft of cooking, and got really angry that Americans didn't appreciate the craft of cooking. But he says that's changed and now people do.
I think the awareness has grown in so much that you see a lot more emphasis in popular media. His shows, the shows on the Food Network, the growth of the foodie. But I think, you know, that's always existed, but people were content to get by with, you know, subpar, you know, prepared dishes and food, because, you know, that's the way it was. But I think as Americans as a whole eat out more percentage-wise than eat at home, I think perhaps the standards have increased because people aren't willing to say, well, okay, you know, I don't have enough time to make dinner tonight. We can get by with going to the Denny's or whatever. But now when that's your only method of eating out, you tend to be a lot more picky because, like, you know what? If I'm going to spend money to eat out, I want to eat something that's tasty, not something that just, you know, is going to fill my stomach.
I don't know. I mean, that all has a sort of internal logic. But my gut feeling is that that's not it, or that's not the majority reason. Because, I mean, people do eat at home. They just more often than not they eat frozen food cooked up in a microwave, and anything, any kind of fast food is going to be better than that. So, you know, why not? And this is because what I'm saying is, like, okay, I see your argument and why fast food takes off, because it's like, well, you know, instead of eating that bland, tasteless piece of frozen food in my fridge, I'll get a burger, and it won't be amazing, but it'll be fast, and it'll be fresh, and it'll be hot, and it'll be better than what I'd have at home. And I think it kind of peters out after that. Do you think maybe it's just specialization? If people start, because there's a big jump from eating fast food to eating in an actual sit down restaurant like a Denny's or something, even.
I think most of it. I mean, if the numbers, you know, statistics are to go by. You know, Americans eat more processed food than they ever have. So, you know, I'm wondering if it's just because, you know, now the awareness for these other types of foods have become popular because, you know, thanks to the cable television, the internet, you know, those formerly disparate groups can now, you know, form an audience that you couldn't have before. And advertisers are more willing to say, well, hey, now you have, you know, someone you can, you know, maybe 100,000, 200,000 people you can sell your wares to. As before, you know, when you're relying just on print media and broadcast television, I mean, you're essentially trying to broadcast to the whole of America. You're going to, you know, lowest common denominator, you're going to go with, you know, the products that would appeal to the broadest segment of the population.
Although that processed food attitude is changing. I think it's sort of a 20-year-old trope to say, like, oh, people just eat anything that's, you know, massively produced and processed. It's changed. People, there's all this controversy over trans fats. There's all this, there's been a push for natural foods for a long time. And now you see even like the peanut butter makers coming out with a natural version of their peanut butter. And so there's been, I think, here's what I think happened, is processed food came out and was very convenient. And people said, well, this is great. It's cheap. It's convenient. I can, you know, it's tasty, smooth. I don't even have to stir the peanut butter or whatever. And then they didn't realize what all the negatives were. They didn't realize the downsides. And it took a long time for that to trickle out and people to come up to speed and go, oh, wait a minute, there's a huge downside here. And so now there seems to be a slight pressure on that. And it's, I'm not saying that processed foods are gone or that that they're even under threat, but
I'm not arguing any of those,
adapting with to the pressures. And I feel like processed food is actually becoming less processed.
I think part of that is, I think part of that is perception. I mean, we both live in an area where people are more than likely to be very picky about how food is prepared, how food is delivered, and you know, the types of ingredients that go into it. You know, I mean, if we could do a sampling of different regions of the country, you know, and kind of average that out, I mean, it's like, you know, out here, things that where we have, especially in San Francisco, very conscientious about the way we recycle and get rid of our garbage. You know, in San Francisco, I have to separate the compost, which includes any leftover food that hasn't been eaten, you know, orange peels, things like that, recycle for recyclable goods. And then the whole goal is to make my actual trash as small as possible. What I'm trying to say is what goes for us may not go for the rest of the country.
Yeah, but I'm basing my observation on what I see when I travel in other parts of the country. I assume when I'm in San Francisco that what I'm seeing is only in San Francisco. And there's even differences in the North Bay from San Francisco, and definitely differences in Oakland and the East Bay from San Francisco. But I kind of set all that aside. And observations I have here, I'm kind of like, this is fairyland. This is almost like not being in the rest of the United States. So I discount that. But when I go to Atlanta, when I go back to Greenville, Illinois, which I haven't been there in a while, but when I go to other areas of the country, I'm surprised at how similar the food options are in a lot of ways at promoting the health and the wholesome ingredients and having.
I'm not saying
really
that,
nice
that
places
people are against health.
I'm not saying you're saying that either. I'm just saying I don't think it's just a Bay Area thing. I think there is a greater push for this nationwide.
I think, you know, the cynical part of me would chalk that up to mostly marketing, where people or companies are essentially labeling things as a healthy alternative when in fact they might be just moderately more healthy than the product that they replaced.
Oh, that's a very good point. Yeah, I've got a good example of that.
Just because I know people are always willing to make a buck somehow. This happened 10 years ago where people were like kind of rolling out all these, you know, all natural food products and you know, no this, you know, no trans fats, no this. But, you know, what it ended up was the food was still just as unhealthy for you. Granted, it did not have the trans fats. It didn't have, you know, the MSG, but it had huge amounts of sodium, had all these other things that, you know, you shouldn't eat in large quantities. So, you know, are you just substituting one you know, bad thing for another because you can sell it easier to a willing public.
Yeah, I think a really good example of that is Skippy natural peanut butter. I bought it at the grocery store, I usually buy my peanut butter from Trader Joe's, which not everybody has that chain, but they usually have higher quality ingredients and better food generally. Even their frozen food is better than what you would get normally at a grocery store. But I was not there, so I picked this up, and it's perfectly smooth. But it says it's all natural ingredients. I look at the ingredients. There's no hydrogenated oils. There's nothing, you know, there's no unpronounceable ingredients or anything like that. So I'm like, okay, what's the deal? Because this is totally smooth peanut butter that looks just like the stuff that's more processed. What did they do? Well, one of the three ingredients besides peanuts and salt was palm oil, which sounds perfect like they. That's perfectly natural, right? You just take some palms and you press it and you get the palm oil. It's just like corn oil or any kind of other natural oil, right? It's not hydrogenated. It's not been processed. Oh. But it turns out that palm oil is linked to heart disease because even though it's perfectly natural, it's also one of the naturally highest saturated fats that you can find. And so that's what they're doing is saying, you know what? Okay, fine. We're going to take a step back, and we're going to find a natural replacement. So granted, we haven't made huge progress, but I think it does push us down that road to higher quality ingredients when they say, look, you can't take the shortcut anymore. If you're going to come up with something unhealthy, you've got to try a little harder. And I think overall, you still do see more examples of foods that are actually healthier, not just natural or not just, you know, health ingredients than you ever did 20 years ago.
I think they need to bring back, like, I don't know what they call it. Back in junior high, high school, you know, it was just under home ec, but essentially, I wouldn't say food science, but essentially nutrition, where you know, as part of a health class, you literally have to sit through and understand what all these foods, you know, do to you. And there's actually a great test that my health teacher did is that, you know, we were doing some exercises, you know, simple calisthenics, and then he would have us basically taste some refined sugar. And what he did was we had to hold up our hands this way, and then he would put his hands on top, and we were basically supposed to push up. And you know, normally it would be fine, but right after everyone like just took a finger full of fine sugar, you couldn't push back up. He wasn't even pushing down. It was just putting the weight of his arms on your hand and they would just slowly sink down. And it was the funniest thing. It's like, you know, that's the thing with refined sugar is that your body processes it incredibly fast because unlike starches and stuff that take time or the carbohydrates, it takes time to break down.
I'm a little suspicious of that. Did you do the similar experiment with honey?
We did not have any honey available.
Or any other kind of unrefined sugar?
You mean like fruit?
Well, because I'm wondering perhaps? If it's not, doesn't have to do with anything refined, but just the fact that if you take in a lot of sugar, your body is, you know, distracted. Well, like it doesn't matter whether it's refined or unrefined.
Well, I think that was the point though. Like,
okay.
His point he was making is that your body generally, you know, aside if you come across a huge cache of you know, plums or something, takes time to break down a lot of, you know, complex carbohydrates, starches, potatoes, pasta, stuff like that. When you start loading up with products that have nothing but refined sugar in it, like sports drinks that are supposedly healthy, candy bars, things like that, people like a Snickers.
Well, I'm just saying it doesn't matter if it's refined or not. If the majority ingredient is sugar, even if it's fructose, you know, or not high fructose corn syrup, but like pure fructose or honey or something like that, wouldn't it have the same effect?
Well, what I'm saying is, yes, you know, if you had a going back to my original point was if we had essentially a class or some that, you know, gave the basics of nutrition in a non, you know, covered in a week and then you're done kind of way, I think at least people would have a better, at least better understanding. I could be wrong. Maybe I'm just overestimating the power of education.
Well, no, I mean, we've covered on this show plenty of times how, you know, we don't educate people properly in this country or in a lot of other countries, simply because we push them through the system. The school system is incredibly ridiculously messed up. I've been watching The Wire as part of the great The Wire experiment that I'm doing on the show Frame Rate with Brian Brushwood.
What's the experiment?
The experiment is for me and Brian to watch all five seasons within a couple months. And one of the seasons focuses on education and the problems with the education system. Now, granted, they're using Baltimore as an example. They're using inner city schools as an example. So it's the worst of the worst. But it does really bring out the issues that an educational system faces when somebody does try to actually teach kids or help kids, and the barriers that are put in place by a bureaucracy. Now, a lot of people jump and say, yes, that's why we need privatized schools, or yes, that's why we need to fund schools better. But funding isn't the question, isn't the answer. Privatization isn't the answer. It's standardization. Any organization, private or public, this is the big thing that I'm getting from watching The Wire, is that it doesn't matter whether your organization is a company, a government bureaucracy, or a drug dealing organization. Once it gets to a certain size, you can't move. You can't make things happen. You can't have vision. You run into all sorts of obstacles, and every good thing you do is almost in spite of the size and the impediments of your organization, because you don't have somebody at the top really grasping the problem and going after it creatively. You have a lot of people trying to do little parts, and we don't countenance any kind of organizational psychology. We don't countenance any kind of productive good sociology. We don't expect anyone in business or anyone in an executive position to understand how organizations work. And so they don't.
I agree. I mean, you know, one of the comments made with large like GM and IBM, at least IBM of 10 to 15 years ago, was that as they reached a certain size, they started acting less like a company and more like a government. And, you know, when they meant government, they meant the bureaucracy, all the different departments you had to go through, all the different people that had to agree on one thing for it to move forward to the next stage. And, you know, I'm wondering if businesses and just you know, bureaucracies in general can't, you know, reach a certain size where they no longer can be effective, where they need to be split off or you know, rationalized in a different way, because you know the past solution to bad bureaucracy was to throw more bureaucracy on it. So you know, it's such a confounding problem. Yeah. Because so many people are involved, and you know, and it's weird because you literally need need everyone's help to get things fixed. But you know, if you're dealing with 100, 1,000, 10,000 people in an organization, I mean, how do you get that stuff through?
And most of the people in an organization, and I don't mean this as a pejorative, but most of the people in an organization actually only concerned about preserving their job. Perfectly rational behavior. That's not a horrible thing. There are people who are more career and promotion oriented. They want to move up the ladder, right? But there's also people who are like, you know what? Moving up the ladder would be nice. I'd like more money, but really, I just want to do my job and do it right. And they are the people who are the have the best intentions at heart, and interlockingly, not any one of them, but with enough of them, cause the impediment, because they don't do anything overtly that you could point at and say you are doing this and it's hurting this organization. But collectively, through all of the small decisions that are made, that kind of hold off on anything crazy, hold off on anything risky, cause organizations to grind to a halt.
Well, it's funny because past experience at a job I had maybe 6-5 years ago, there were people who were literally, you know, content with carving out their little fiefdom in the organization and just staying there, doing the minimum amount of work to get by so they could, you know, enough to so they could get their check and they could keep their job. It was literally it. And it was so disheartening because, you know, there's so many things that were like, you know, held together with bubble gum and baling wire. It's just like, come on, it's you know, just because you have it good doesn't mean that everyone needs to suffer because you don't want to change things because it might, you know, threaten the way you can come into work late and not do anything or just do the bare minimum, you know, where there were more worried about appearing to be, you know, productive rather than actually being productive.
Well, and I have to say that you're absolutely right. But then there are also people who are better than that, who are actually fairly productive, yeah, and who don't.
No, I agree.
Every single idea, and yet they still impede that progress.
Well, that's what I mean. There was plenty of people in the group that were, you know, they would spend the extra hours. They would stay until 9 o'clock. That would, you know, do the extra workload. But, it didn't mean anything because at the end, you couldn't get past that one roadblock. You know, that one person or the one or two, you know, individuals that were literally keeping everything, you know, from moving forward. And it was just so frustrating that you literally just went home, throw your hands up in the air. It's like, what's the point? Why do I come to work?
And I think two interesting examples, and obviously they're from the tech world because that's what I know most closely these days. But two examples of companies trying to fight off that malaise are Google and Apple, and they're going about it in entirely different ways. But
are they building robots?
Google is trying everything. I don't claim to have a handle on all the things that they do, but there's things like you hear about the "Don't Be Evil" motto and the 20% time, and only hiring a certain kind of person to work there, and trying to come up with all of these ways to prevent the bureaucracy from becoming what it normally becomes.
That totally sounds like a cult.
Yeah,
totally.
Well, it can. I mean, you can make any company sound like a cult if you try, though. I mean, that's just the nature of any large organization is going to sound like a cult. But I don't think they're trying to be cult-like. I think what they're trying to do is figure out what are the conditions that we put in place for our employees without you can't just mandate like everyone be creative and don't be a stumbling block. What are the conditions that create that same atmosphere that you get naturally at the beginning when it's just a few people working on it, like Sergey and Larry when they began? How do they, their big challenge has been, how do we maintain that atmosphere of creativity?
I don't know. They might have to do an annual, whoever doesn't finish this creative race gets cut from the company.
Yeah.
You know, kind of put a little spark in their seat.
One of the things that I think Google does right, which is they're not terribly afraid to make mistakes, as obviously with Google Wave and Frugal
it's interesting you say that because I was reading The Economist maybe 2-3 months ago about Silicon Valley, or rather other countries trying to replicate Silicon Valley. And they did a story on Russia's version of Silicon Valley. And, the government was pouring money in and they're building all these new, high-tech complexes, these campuses and stuff. And, they hired a consultant who came over and, said, do you guys really want to know what the secret to Silicon Valley is? And, they're all around the table. They're all eagerly, listening to hear that one magic, word that would solve everything. It's like, you need to let people fail. Having the ability to fail and fail repeatedly is not, considered a sign abject failure, but rather a learning process where, okay, this product didn't work, this service didn't work, I'm going to learn from that. I'm going to build what I know from what I've learned, and then I can build a better product, I can build a better service. And then only that way can you provide the kind of dynamic, corporate, or at least, forward-looking culture, because, yeah, we'll take risks and, we're going to bite the bullet every now and then, but that's what you need to do to stay ahead or get ahead or develop something new that no one's seen before, because if you're always too conservative, no one's willing to stick their neck out on anything. You're always going to get a slow, gradual, evolution of whether product or service. But, by 20 years time, it might be too, clunky, too unwieldy, or just too old to meet the demands of the consumer at that time.
Now, on the other side of the street, almost literally, you have Apple, which I don't claim to know how they run internally either, but from what I have read and what I have gleaned, Steve Jobs obviously takes a big role in everything they do. So there's a lot of that that control exerted from the top, which has the good advantage of getting rid of a lot of impediments and bureaucracy, because when Steve says it's going to get done, it's going to get done. And he said, I read something recently, just in the past couple of days, that in Apple they focus on what they want to achieve at the exclusion of all else, versus in a lot of product design where you say, oh, I want to achieve a lot of different things and let's see how it all comes together, which is why you end up with these annoying things like, why is there no cut and paste in the original iPhone? Yep. And why do we not have real multitasking still? We have this sort of virtual multitasking on the iPhone. And why doesn't, you know, my computer do this or do that? Because Steve Jobs sets it and says, we want it to do this, very focused, designed to that. Don't worry about anything else. Don't go outside the lines. And it's the opposite of the Google approach, was like, hey, let's make a mistake. Let's fail. Let's try a bunch of stuff. It's let's focus like a laser on this and I will lead you, which this also sounds like a cult, right? But
it is a cult.
Because there's a very fine line between a corporation and a cult. But essentially it's the other take, which is like we're gonna replicate that early, you know, startup mentality by having a very strong vision from one person.
Well, that's kind of the question that you know people have raised repeatedly, especially in light of Steve Jobs' health concerns in the past couple of years. Is that without a Steve Jobs or a Steve Jobs like person at the head of Apple, will it fall back into what it was during the Scully years, where you have a very kind of mishmash kind of wishy-washy approach to products? Product lines and product design, where you have all these different departments, doing all sorts of different things. None of it, which I hate to use this word because Patrick hates to use this word, is synergy. Where you have, you can literally have
buzzword.
Synergy. Where you have a theme, like one of the big things that Apple's done recently is kind of tie everything into the iTunes store. Including, the App Store and stuff. So, they've built that, but, can you do that if you didn't have a very, forceful, very direct personality like Steve Jobs? So, it could be one of those things where Apple is essentially an extension of Steve Jobs. And then when he, steps down or whatever, that will no longer be an Apple. That will be another technology company.
All right. Well, let's read out a few of the comments from sabrilliant.com/EMW. That's the East Meets West website. D-Dog says, if you enjoyed Scott Pilgrim, I would highly recommend getting the video game. There's a few issues with the game, especially because of the lack of online multiplayer. But overall, like the movie, it was really fun and creative. The entire game is a throwback to classic 8-bit gaming. It's fun playing through just to look for some game references, TMNT, Mega Man, SMB, etc. The soundtrack is great, too. Several of stage songs have been stuck in my head all week. Have you played the video game?
No,
I gotta try it.
I haven't seen it on Xbox Live, and I will not own a PlayStation. Really? I don't know. I've noticed this trend, with chiptunes and stuff, where that a lot of people are kind of bringing back the whole 8-bit kind of universe. And I remember living through it that I didn't really find it all that remarkable. I found the music really annoying, and I found the character designs. Some of them were really brilliant. Other times they weren't so hot. So I bet you it's totally based on age. When people were doing versions of the 2600, I would be giggling, but I don't know, 8-bit. Maybe it's just overdone.
There's a lot of 8-bit out there. That's true.
They need to move to 16. Genesis,
SNES. Eric wrote, I think you might be asking too much of the sandwich concept. They're one of the original convenience foods and as such have some inherent compromises. When sandwich shops get too precious with what they sell, they start eroding away some of what I like about sandwiches. For example, quick, portable, and reasonably priced. I also happen to think there's something to be said for the consistency of a Subway or D'Angelo's. My job takes me all over southern Massachusetts and Rhode Island, and it's sort of nice knowing what you're going to get, even if it's not made from the meat of animals that were grass-fed, massaged twice daily, and read Goodnight Moon before bedtime every night, served on fine artisan breads. To me, at least, a meatball marinara $5 footlong is worth exactly $5 to me, and I am okay with that.
I agree with Eric in so much that I believe in the consistency. I have nothing against fast food or any chain restaurants in principle. What I don't like is what I've seen, time after time is that they start out really good, and then over the years they start cutting corners, and the quality, the taste, the service, and all that starts to diminish. Subway used to be really good. I really can't eat any of the sandwiches anymore. It actually gives me heartburn, which it didn't 5 years ago. So they either switched to a new kind of bread recipe, or maybe it's just the local ones in the Bay Area that have this issue, but it's just like, I can't eat it.
Well, you know, the thing about it is, if you're a progressively minded individual who wants to rail against the system, it's very easy to complain about chains and their quality. And I'm not saying that's what you're doing right now, but you know what I'm talking about. People are like, oh, I never eat a chain. Chains are awful. Food's disgusting. I can't believe anyone eats there. But they only exist because everyone eats there. And I think everyone eats there because of what Eric's saying. Yeah. You know what? It's not the greatest sandwich shop in the world, but when I'm traveling or I'm lazy or I just don't know, $5 meatball sub is worth $5 to me. I think he totally crystallized why it is we have chain fast food right there.
In fact, only chain actually will gravitate to in general is Taco Bell. I know it sounds weird, but I actually like their chicken tacos because it's one of the few places that okay, it's frozen meat, but it tastes like chicken. It doesn't taste like processed something.
Well, that's the thing about Taco Bell. You can identify every single ingredient. I think that's why people give them a pass a lot, because you could look at it and you're like, well, the only place they could really be hiding anything is the beans. And if you actually do some research, you could find out what ingredients they put in the beans, and they don't put a lot of weird ingredients even in the beans, at least that they admit. So you're looking and you're like, yeah, that's lettuce, and maybe a little wilted, but it's definitely lettuce. And those are tomatoes. They're kind of sour, but they're definitely tomatoes. You look at some processed fried chicken foods that are chopped up, you don't know what all has been put in there or sprayed on it to make it look good. So
the McRib is actually the perfect case in point. Yeah, I don't want to go too long in it, but you know, they literally used an iron to imprint the grill marks on it, but it's just, you know, it's basically processed meat. It's pressed meat. And I find it the funniest thing because some guy literally washed off the barbecue sauce the last time they brought it out just to show everyone what it looked like.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
All right, folks, thanks for watching or listening, however you consumed today's East Meets West. We know most of you listen, and we thank you for that. We also thank Jammer B for running the board back at Twit. We do the show live every Sunday at 5 p.m. Pacific Time, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks to Leo for letting us do it on the network there. And Roger, thank you for always providing a counterpoint.
It's good because I think it makes for a more interesting show.
Thanks, everybody, for paying attention. And you can make your comments at subbrilliant.com/EMW. We'll talk to you next time.
Bye.